Intelligent design and DNA. The scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
And we've reached the conclusion, Fred, of our list of problems with star formation, but we have an important and sad announcement first.
Yeah, Dennis Hofs, who is a dear friend of mine, he recently passed away. And, you know, Bob, he was one of the most dedicated champions of creation I've ever known. He was an early member of Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship.
Yeah.
You know, really helped get that going. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting, you know, his daughter told me that the chaplain was able to get in to see him. You know, unfortunately, in this coronavirus situation, she wasn't able to. But she said the first thing that Dennis said when he talked to the chaplain was that he wanted to spread the word on creation. That's
wow.
His mind.
So, Fred, he's ready to go see his maker, and he wants others also to have that opportunity, that eternal blessing, to meet your maker, not as judge, but as your savior and your Lord.
Yeah. And he was always so encouraging of me. And I just really enjoyed his friendship. In fact, he encouraged me to include in my last talk, which was on information science at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship meeting. And that video is online, by the way, at youngearth.org.
Yeah.
But he encouraged me to include at the end of my talk the design of life at conception, and especially the incredible design of polyspermia, and how that cannot possibly be explained by evolution or any kind of naturalistic origin.
Yeah, and that polyspermia, that's where the human ovum prevents fertilization by multiple sperm. It's so astounding, Fred. Yeah, and Dennis was right to point that out. Aspect of life and reproduction.
Yeah, it's an enormous engineering problem, and you can see more details on that at the end of my talk. Just, you know, find the video and then go towards the end.
That's great.
And graphics on it that really helps explain why that would be impossible to happen from a naturalistic point of view.
And again, that video is at youngearth.org.
Yes. And again, just, you know, really going to miss Dennis, but he's with the Lord now. And I really appreciated his friendship through the years.
And when we get there ourselves, hopefully he'll give us a tour.
Yeah, absolutely.
Show us around, because heaven's going to be an amazing place.
Yep, absolutely.
So now we're near the end of our list of problems with star formation. Really, Fred, I could only think of one more specific problem, and that's matter itself. So antimatter, we got to talk about that.
But Bob, first, not everybody would have heard our quotes from astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. Remember him?
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, NASA scientist John Brand.
Yeah.
For new listeners to realize it's not only creationists who know of these problems, Bob.
Yeah, because when you catch an astronomer with his guard down, he admits these are severe and completely unresolved problems, although in public they almost always ignore or downplay them. And so let's demonstrate that right now. So you mentioned Neil Smoking deGrasse Tyson about gas clouds in space, which are supposed to be what contracts to form stars. He wrote this, quote, "We know the cloud wants to collapse under its own weight to make one or more stars, but rotation as well as turbulent motion within the cloud work against that. So too does the ordinary gas pressure you learned about in high school chemistry class. Galactic magnetic fields also collapse, therein restricting the ways in which the cloud will respond to its self-gravity. The scary part is that if none of us knew in advance that stars exist, research would offer plenty of convincing reasons for why stars could never form." Fred, that's our whole argument.
Oh, man. Yeah. And then, you know, it just shows their circular reasoning, too, in that last statement he made.
Yeah, because they believe it had to happen, even though the hard science says that it would never happen.
Yep. And you know, things haven't changed much since the, again, NASA scientist John Brand, he wrote this: the contemporary opinion on star formation holds that objects called protostars are formed as condensations from the interstellar gas. This condensation process is very difficult theoretically, and no essential theoretical understanding can be claimed. In fact, some theoretical evidence argues strongly against the possibility of star formation. Right. Imagine that.
So, Fred, if you were on Facebook or some forum like your own, evolutionfairytale.com, and you said to an evolutionist, an atheist, a materialist, you know, there's strong evidence against the possibility of star formation, the typical atheist, evolutionist, Big Bang proponent, they would cackle, they'd mock you like you were a moron, like you didn't know how to read, except that this is the hard truth that their side is in denial over.
Yep.
So on Real Science Radio, we make lists. That's our thing, Fred.
Oh, big time, yeah.
Like our list of Big Bang predictions. And our lists
get to be really long. There's a reason.
Yeah, there's a reason these lists are so long. That's absolutely right. And we have so many of them, dozens of them, like our list of evidence against the Big Bang, or even our list of problems with whale evolution, dozens of these. And one of the reasons we could make them, and they're so rich and so deep with information, is because there are these rare moments of candor among evolutionists and astrophysicists who essentially are atheists, when they admit that there are major scientific discoveries that undermine the most fundamental claims of their theories, but they never, ever do what we do, Fred. They never, as far as we've seen and we have looked, they never, ever, ever try to list all the problems against their own theory.
And then the media will ignore those rare moments of candor that you mentioned.
Yeah, right. They ignore that. They only list a few and typically hand wave them away with their faith, blind faith, that eventually they will find the answers. The opposite of that, Fred, is like what we do with the global flood and the hydroplate theory. There's an argument against Dr. Walt Brown's model for how the global flood occurred and an accusation against it. It's called the heat problem. So mechanical engineer Brian Nickel and I, we listed 20 specific heat problems that opponents have claimed. We list them all. They're online. And we went through them one by one on the air to ask, is our theory able to answer these objections? And that was a lot of fun. Too bad the Big Bang proponents don't do that, huh, Fred?
Yeah. And, you know, on the other hand, you think about the countless network television nature program episodes like on Nova, National Geographic, and, you know, BBC.
Yeah.
They're so confident, and they dramatically oversell like a snake oil salesman all their goods.
Wow.
They don't list any of these problems.
Yeah.
They totally fly in the face of what they're claiming.
Yeah. If viewers observe carefully, I think they can notice something ironic about the scripts of these nature television programs, like on the Discovery Channel and so on. When you start, as they do, like as Stephen Hawking did, with nothing created everything.
Yeah.
Or zero plus zero equals everything. There's no end to the mistakes that you'll make. So almost everything they say, and in a moment, listeners could see how we'll substantiate this. Almost everything they say disproves everything they believe, which is based on nothing.
Yeah, then, you know, then they get into the sophistication of life on Earth, which is utterly impossible to explain.
Via materialism, right.
Yeah, because life is one of my favorite topics. It's information-based, and information clearly is not physical.
Yeah.
Even though you'll get evolutionists that will try to tell you information is physical.
Right, it's absurd. Like, I like to ask them, is the number three physical? The number three.
That's a really good way to put it.
And we had a PhD physicist at lunch after church a while back. There's about, I think, eight of us went to lunch. And he was insisting, he's an atheist, that the number three is physical, that three. And his sister, who's a math teacher, his sister was just asking him, are you serious? You're throwing a tantrum here. The number three is not physical. Fred, I like to ask them, is the square root of -1 physical? Because the square root of -1 is an imaginary number. yet it's crucial for understanding quantum mechanics. It's a concept that engineers can use to design systems like electric circuits, but it doesn't exist in the physical world, the concept. But it's a concept used in design, and it's a concept that God, the Creator, obviously used when he designed the physical universe at its most fundamental quantum level. So, Fred, I'm glad you brought this up, this problem, because obviously it's outside of the domain of astronomy. But you and I, we're talk show hosts, right? We're allowed to go on tangents.
That's right.
So think about our 3-to-1 evolution challenge. Let any atheist try to devise an algorithm whereby 3 DNA letters symbolize 1 amino acid. That's how proteins are built. And that's the very simplest part of the genetic code. Not the most complex, but the simplest part of it. Fred, what answer do they have to how that would arise? 3 nucleotides represent a single amino acid.
Yeah, how does that get defined? You know, how does that come about? They don't have a clue. They never can have a clue.
No.
How a code can arise from matter.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a genuine code, a symbolic scheme. You know, the Nobel Prize was awarded for discovery of the genetic code.
Wow. You're talking C-O-D-E. Code, C-O-D-E. This is an actual, I have atheists in, when we debate online, they say, well, the genetic code is not really a code. It's not a code.
And
that's exactly what the Nobel Prize was awarded for, the discovery of the genetic code. And a code is a schema. It's based on symbolism, like Morse code or the ASCII code for letters on your computer screen. And the classical laws of physics and chemistry, they have no symbolic logic. And that's one of the reasons why the genetic code cannot arise from matter and energy.
Yeah, and if you're interested in these matters, there's a great page at our website, rsr.org/atheism.
Oh, it's so fun. And then, Fred, I know we got to get back to the stars, but how about human consciousness? If they don't have a theory, they claim that they've done a pretty good job of explaining origins without God, without our Creator. Well, if they don't have a theory to explain us, they don't have a theory of origins. If they don't have even a rough hypothesis to explain human consciousness, then they have no theory of origins. They can't explain planet formation. They can't explain the moon, star formation, the origin of life, consciousness, nothing.
Nothing. They rely too much on nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing's big to them.
Yeah. You're so funny, Fred. Yeah, that's like when we had Dr. Lawrence Krauss on the show for his book, The Universe from Nothing. And it's so funny. You could find that at rsr.org/Krauss. So almost everything they say contradicts almost everything they believe. And as an example of this, one of the big problems with star formation is, and we should have a drum roll here, where do they get the gas from that's supposed to collapse to form a star?
Well, Bob, you'd think that'd be easy, no? The matter, the atoms, the molecules that make up the nebula floating in space.
Yeah.
That matter comes from the Big Bang, back when nothing created everything.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
that, Bob?
Yeah, even if let's say there's a multiverse, and in some pre-existing universe, an infinite chain back, there was a quantum fluctuation, and that is what caused the Big Bang. Let's say that. Let's give them that. So then the energy released in the Big Bang is what supposedly, in 20 minutes, created all the matter of the universe. But there's an enormous problem with that. And me and Fred, if we say that the Big Bang theory doesn't actually explain where matter could come from, the atheist tuning in, Fred, there's no chance he's going to believe us, right?
Probably not. But how about we listen to a video about the problem made by Fermi Lab?
Ooh.
You know, that the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory?
Oh, yeah, they're out near Chicago. I love those guys, even though they're big bangers, but they're really awesome.
Yeah, so we should listen to this video. So they're the perfect scientists to explain the problem.
Yeah, because they operate under the Department of Energy, and they specialize in high-energy particle physics. So, yeah, let's hear it.
The best-known equation in all of science is Einstein's famous E equals mc squared. Stated simply, the equation says that energy, which is the E, equals mass, which is the M. The C squared term is just a conversion factor, like when you convert feet to meters. The understanding that mass and energy were the same was a revolutionary idea, but that's only part of the story. In 1928, physicist Paul Dirac realized that not only were energy and matter equivalent, but there existed another substance called antimatter. I've talked about antimatter in another video, which you can watch for more information. However, I'll give you the highlights here. Antimatter is basically the opposite of matter. If antimatter touches matter, the two substances completely annihilate one another and convert into energy. The converse is also true. Energy can convert into matter and antimatter. And this is a crucial point. When energy converts to matter, it also converts into antimatter at the same time. And not some random amount of antimatter. The amount of matter created and the amount of antimatter created are identical. This graphic drives the point home. Energy can turn into matter and antimatter, and the amount of matter and antimatter is equal. Keep that in mind as I redirect your attention to a long, long time ago, just fractions of a second after the Big Bang. The universe was full of a roiling maelstrom of energy, with energy converting into matter and antimatter and back again. This was the cauldron of creation, the very foundry in which the universe itself was forged. As the Big Bang unfolded, the universe expanded and cooled. And as it cooled, the energy dropped below the point at which it can convert into matter and antimatter. Because the universe expanded, the separation between matter and antimatter particles would grow. In the simplest scenario, that's it. The remaining matter and antimatter would wander around the cosmos, occasionally meeting and annihilating. As we peered into the sky, we'd expect to see a cooling cosmos with equal amounts of matter and antimatter, an occasional flash of energy signifying a chance meeting between these two antagonistic substances. Simple, right? There's only one problem. That's not what we see.
Yeah.
Everywhere you look, you see only matter. I'm made of matter. You're made of matter. Everything we can see in our biggest telescopes is matter. There is simply no antimatter to be found. The prediction of equal amounts of matter and antimatter is completely falsified. When a theory is falsified this badly, something has to be changed. So what gives? Do we have to reject Einstein's famous equation? Is the idea of antimatter wrong? Do we need to discover another explanation? What do we know?
Stop the tape, stop the tape. So what do they know? Fred, I think if folks go to our online show page that they could find from rsr.org/stars, they can see the rest of that. It's just 4 minutes long. They can't even explain where the matter came from, the gas in the nebula that's supposed to form the stars. None of that matter should be there because the equal amounts of antimatter that a Big Bang or a conversion from energy to matter would create, it would all annihilate itself.
So, Bob, where are they hiding all this antimatter? Yeah. I mean, it's so simple and straightforward.
Yeah.
It really does falsify the Big Bang. The antimatter should be everywhere.
Yes, the antimatter should be everywhere. Like every time we see a galaxy, every other galaxy should be an antimatter galaxy, and they're not. We know from looking at the light. And every other nebula within a galaxy should be antimatter, but they're not. Every other star should be antimatter, or they're not. Or it all should have annihilated itself, so there should be no matter left from which a gas cloud in space itself could form. So another problem, Fred.
Ultimately, Bob, it just doesn't matter to them.
It doesn't matter. So we're being literal when we argue that almost everything they say contradicts what they believe, because certainly they talk about things that are made of matter. And even at that level, it contradicts their materialist worldview.
Yeah. And as we mentioned before, I bet you, Bob, if we pulled you know, 1,000 people who know about the Big Bang but aren't scientists, they're lay persons, they wouldn't know about this problem. These problems are never really talked about. You have to kind of dig to find them.
Right, exactly. And we have a video. In fact, folks have purchased so many of these from us on DVD and Blu-ray and download. And that's what helps us stay on the air to reach more and more people when people purchase our resources. In that video, it's titled RSR's List of Evidence Against the Big Bang. And that list was reviewed by an astrophysicist, one of the world's most accomplished physicists down in Australia, Dr. John Hartnett. And after reviewing our list of evidence, he said, he was on the air, it's in the video, he said, Bob, you guys have done a good job. This is great research. These are valid problems.
Yeah, it's a really well-produced video that you can get at rsr.org/store.
Yes. Thank
highly,
you, Fred.
Highly recommend that video. It's you did a great job with that video, Bob. It's really well done. People will enjoy it.
Thank you, Fred. So now continuing, actually, we're up to the galaxies because we reached the point in the argument where recognizing that stars make up galaxies, there are also insurmountable problems with galaxies that, therefore, that makes more problems for stars.
Here's the ones we've already listed on prior shows.
Yeah.
We've already done huge galaxies, spiral galaxies, the huge and spiral galaxies.
Yeah.
Clustered galaxies, and then a galaxy superclusters.
Oh, yeah. And Fred, you mentioned of the different superclusters, you mentioned that the Big Bang model can't explain their existence. One of them, you said, was the Sloan Great Wall of galaxies. That one's a stunner.
It is. Here's an interesting quote we didn't include last time from one of our favorite science writers. He's an evolutionist, but he's a good writer, and this is from Science News. He said this, "The map's most eye-catching feature is the Sloan Great Wall of galaxies, a clustering of galaxies that stretches 1.37 billion light years across the sky and is the largest cosmic structure ever found."
Wow.
Astronomers worried that such a humongous structure, 80% bigger than the famous Great Wall of Galaxies first discerned in a sky survey 2 decades ago, might violate the accepted model of galaxy evolution.
Yeah, it might. And since Ron Cohen wrote that, there have been even larger structures that have been identified. This is all so awesome, Fred. The recognition that even if there were clumps of dark matter that happened to form stars, that's one of their proposed rescue devices, or that formed galaxies, or even that formed clusters, how about the peculiar shapes that violate the most fundamental predictions of the Big Bang model, that is that the universe would be homogeneous and isotropic at every level up to the entire universe? We've got filaments of galaxies, thousands of them, and we have walls. And here you said the Sloan Great Wall. There are bubbles, galaxies that appear to form bubbles, where just like a regular bubble you blow out of water and soap, the galaxy cluster density is mostly on the sphere. The inside of it has a very low density of galaxies. So, Fred, a lot of problems with the Big Bang model from every direction you approach it.
Yep. And, you know, the Bible says the heavens declare the glory of God. I think we know where that, you know, this is obviously design.
Mm.
But what about the even temperature that we see throughout the universe?
Oh, yeah, that's a big one. And I think we should quote a secular science source to drive this home. But the problem is this, the whole universe, it's called the CMB. If folks want to know the true story of the CMB, just like we played that video, Fred, about the Big Bang's problem with matter and antimatter, we have another video from Secular Science showing that the problems with the CMB itself are enormous.
And that's that cosmic microwave background radiation, right?
Yes, and that's supposed to be one of the three main proofs of the Big Bang theory itself, is the CMB. And Fred, in our video, part two of our Big Bang video, we take on those three predictions.
Yeah, they acted like they predicted that.
Yeah, so unbelievably fascinating. And the CMB argument, just like the matter-antimatter, it's falling apart in the hands of the astronomers. If the whole universe is, which it appears to be, and this was known before the Bell Labs discovery of the static that they were getting in their huge receiver as they're trying to pick up radio waves, they get the static from the universe, and it's called the cosmic microwave background. It's exactly like the static on an old TV set with the rabbit ears.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before they had discovered that, the temperature of the universe had been estimated. It was really amazing what a good job they did, even before the CMB thing, about knowing that the universe, the interstellar space, it's very cold, but also then it's very uniform in its temperature. Fred, how cold is it out there?
It's really cold. It's 2.73 degrees Kelvin, and there's less than 1 in 10,000 degree variation, which is incredible. It shows how extremely even the temperature is throughout the universe.
Yes,
there's
right.
Very little degree variation.
Oh, and so people could have a conception of that. When we do quantum mechanics, in order to keep entanglement going so that they can process using their quantum algorithms, they've got to keep it really cold. And typically, it's been 1/10 of 1 degree Kelvin. But Fred, lately, they've been able to have it like 15 times warmer, up around 1.5 degrees Kelvin. And that's a huge boon to that whole field, because instead of having to spend millions of dollars to keep it that cold, 1/10 of 1 degree Kelvin, they could spend only thousands of dollars to keep it at 1.5 degrees Kelvin. Anyway, that's a rabbit trail. But what is the problem then if the universe has an even temperature? Well, the problem that reveals is that there would be a tendency to prevent clumping, the kind of clumping that you would need to form galaxies. And so with the universe being of such an even temperature, that tells you about the distribution of matter and energy. And so the gravitational pull at any one point in the universe, the matter at one point should be pulled in every direction three-dimensionally, and that would tend to prevent clumping.
Bob, there's a writer from Science News, Ivar Peterson, and he wrote this: "But this uniformity in the CMB is difficult to reconcile with the obvious clumping of matter in the galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and even larger features extending across vast regions of the universe, such as walls and bubbles that you mentioned earlier, Bob."
That's just amazing. So let's just hit some of these additional problems with galaxies, and people could go online to rsr.org/stars and click on the links and find out more. But Fred, there's a problem with the universe appearing to be fractal. And when something is fractal, that is an expression regarding a geometric figure, a curve, where if you look at one little part of it and then you pull out, the pattern you see when you look at a little part is replicated on the bigger part. And then you pull out further on the bigger part, and the bigger part. Snowflakes do this, for example. Clouds do this. Trees do this. Even forests do this when you compare how many large branches on a tree to how many really large trees in a forest. So the fact that there are scientists who are saying that the universe itself appears to be fractal, that is a serious problem. If it turns out that that's true, just like all these other superstructures, in a sense, that's another superstructure that violates the most fundamental predictions of the Big Bang model, which is homogeneity and isotropy.
Yep, great point. And what about the spiral galaxies being too perfect?
Oh, I love that one, Fred, because they have their prediction about why we see spiral galaxies the way we do, and especially the larger ones, and then they get larger and larger. And they say that they had to be formed from the mergers of other galaxies. But Fred, the closer they look at the different parts of these spiral galaxies, they literally say that this is an embarrassment, and they being leading astronomers like from Princeton and elsewhere, who say it's an embarrassment because these spiral galaxies are too perfect to be true. That's so fun. And there's a related problem about the bulge within our own Milky Way. These bulges in the middle of spiral galaxies, they cause a huge problem. And it turns out even the bulge within our own Milky Way galaxy has its own problem. Fred, then galaxies spin and spiral arms, fast moving arms. These, each one of these things is a serious problem to the Big Bang model.
Yeah, because if billions of years have passed, why do we still see spiral arms, for example?
Right, because we know from observation the relative speed of the stars in the arms and in the center of the galaxies, and what should have happened after only millions of years, not billions, is that the spiral arms, those beautiful arms like pinwheels, they should have deformed within millions of years. They shouldn't still be visible in the way they are. And I'm not saying they're visible necessarily in the visible part of the light spectrum, but the gorgeous spiral galaxies we see, it is known by astrophysicists that those patterns should have been deformed long ago if the Big Bang were true. And so once again, Fred, dark matter comes to the rescue.
And you know, Bob, I just wish, you know, all of these things is an embarrassment to them. They say that, you know, you wish they'd just turn this embarrassment and just, you know, realize, hey, maybe we're wrong. I've been wrong on many things in my life. And I, you know, and when I am, I'm embarrassed about it. And then I try to change, find out what's true.
Yeah.
So I won't be embarrassed again.
Yeah. And the Royal Astronomical Society, they published a new theory of spiral galaxy arm formation. And they've realized, hey, this isn't going to work either, because these arms would break up after only 100 million years, and they're supposed to be billions of years old. So it goes on and on. Fred, I enjoy reading from a longtime editor of the journal Nature. This is one of the top scientists in the world, John Maddox. He's a physicist and 23-year editor of Nature. And he asks this question: which objects came first, stars or galaxies? And Fred, in his book, What Remains to Be Discovered, he says that we don't know enough. Science, our models, they don't tell us what came first, stars or galaxies. It sounds like what came first, the chicken or the egg. The simplest questions are unresolved to the materialist, to the atheist. And so what they're doing is they're overselling their confidence to the general public. When they go on Nova or the Discovery Channel or National Geographic or the BBC, and they say, well, we really have this figured out to where we know you don't need God.
Yeah, and people really buy into it. Bob, you know what? There's so much more we could talk about on this, but it looks like we're out of time.
Yes. So, Fred, I want to thank you during the coronavirus for being on the show over Zoom, right? You've Zoomed in. Is that how you got here?
Yeah, that's how we're doing it.
All right. So thank you for that. And I can't wait to see you again in studio. The sooner the better.
Yeah. And keep those coronavirus shows going, too. Those are awesome.
Well, thank you very, very much. I really appreciate that. So this is Bob Benyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.